We now present an in-depth overview of Purusha Suktam.
Now that we have heard the Purusha Suktam in full, let us reflect on some of its deeper aspects. The first thing we note is that the expression of adoration of the Universal Lord is not unique to the Purusha Suktam. Rather, it is a feeling that extensively pervades Vedic literature. Here are a few samples, starting with a couple of verses from the Shvetasvatara Upanishad. Without beginning and end is He. In the midst of chaos He is, and brings forth all things. Creator is He, and He alone pervades the manifold forms. When a man knows God, he is freed from all fetters. He is the creator of all, the knower of all things, the source of the self, the author of space and time, possessor and master of all qualities, omniscient, the lord of both nature and spirit, who confers liberation from worldly bondage.
The two verses you heard were from the Shvetasvatara Upanishad, and now a few from the Manduka Upanishad. Divine and formless is the person. He is inside, he is outside. He is not begotten, he is not breath or mind, utterly pure, farther than the farthest imperishable. From him spring forth the breath of life, the power of thought, and all the senses, space, wind, light and water, and earth, the great supporter of all. Fire is his head, the sun and moon his eyes, the ears the compass, the Vedas revealed are his words, the wind is his breath, and his heart is the all. From his feet came the earth, in truth he is the inner Atman of all beings. The slokas we have quoted are just samples. Well, anyone who has made an extensive and careful study of the Vedas just cannot but be impressed by the repeated expressions of adoration for the Supreme One and the emphatic assertion that none but Him exists.
We mentioned in the general introduction that one hears extensive chanting of the Vedas during the Yajna that Bhagwan Baba performs during the Navratri festival. It is illuminating to hear what Swami's incomparable biographer, late Mr. Kasturi, has written about the Dasara chants. This is what he says. The Yajna, which is performed for 7 of the 9 days of the festival of Navratri, is a lesson in spiritual science. While witnessing the Yajna, we experience the whole gamut of bliss. It is the bliss of contemplating the formless cosmic principle described in the Upanishads, ancient Indian scriptures, the thrill of conceiving and adoring the sun as the source of light and life, and the joy of installing in our hearts the author of the amazing adventure of creation, sustenance, and dissolution. Baba uses every medium of expression, including the poetry and the music of Vedic chants, to convey to us the message of self-control in order to silence the clamor of the senses and the mind. That was Kasturi commenting on the Vedic chants.
We now come to the theme of Yajna, a recurring theme right across the Vedas. We tend to think of the Yajna as simply a ritual of some sorts accompanied by Vedic chanting. Actually, the word means much more. Let us first hear what Mahatma Gandhi has to say on the subject. Gandhiji says, "Yajna is a word full of beauty and power. Yajna literally means worship, hence also sacrifice, and hence also any sacrificial act or act of service. And in this sense, every age may and should have its own Yajna. That is because mankind lives by Yajna, that is sacrifice. Yajna also means an act directed to the welfare of others, done without receiving or desiring a return for it, whether of a temporal or spiritual nature. The world cannot survive for a single minute without yajna in this sense. That was what Gandhiji wrote about yajna.
We notice from Gandhi's observation that there are three concepts tightly linked to each other. Firstly, yajna. Secondly, sacrifice. And thirdly, action performed for the benefit of others without any expectation of reward. Lord Krishna has a lot to say about these in the Gita. Here is a sample.
At the time of creation, the Creator said to mankind, "Through sacrifice thou shalt prosper and propagate. This shall be the milch cow of thy desires. Worship is a form of sacrifice. Worship the devas or the minor deities, and they in turn will nourish thee. And through this synergy, thou canst attain the highest good. Fostered by sacrifice, the devas will unasked bestow on thee all the enjoyment that thou couldst possibly desire. But he who enjoys the gifts of the devas without offering sacrifice in return is verily a thief. The virtuous who partake of food that remains after the sacrifice is offered are freed from all sin. But the selfish who eat alone without sharing their food with others are in fact feeding on sin. All beings are products of food. Food is nourished by rain, and rain ensures from sacrifice. Sacrifice is the noblest form of action. Know that all action originates from the Supreme One who is imperishable and all-pervading. And in sacrificial action, this Supreme Spirit is consciously present. O Partha, one who does not revolve with the wheel of sacrifice, but seeks instead mundane pleasures through the gratification of the senses, lives in vain. Some offer sacrifice to the devas alone, while others, more evolved, offer ego as a sacrifice in the fire of knowledge. Some others offer the senses such as hearing in the fire of self-control, while others offer sound and other objects of perception to the fire of the senses. Others, kindled by wisdom, sacrifice all activities of the senses and of the vital energy, that is prana, in the fire of self-restraint. Some perform sacrifice using material objects, some through austerity, others via yoga, and some again make the study of the scriptures and the acquisition of knowledge their sacrifice and penance. All these diverse approaches are born of piety. Thus, many and various are the sacrifices enunciated by the Vedas. Know thou them all to spring from the action of the mind, the senses, and the body. Once thou knowest this, thou canst win release. Superior to the sacrifice of material objects is that based on knowledge, for all action which does not bind finds consummation in knowledge."
That was quite a powerful emphasis on sacrifice by the Lord, was it not? As mentioned earlier, sacrifice is a recurring theme in the Vedas, right across the board. Of course, we use the words yajna, sacrifice, offering, and worship interchangeably. Well, what exactly is this sacrifice that one is talking so much about? Swami has the answer. He says, "What is sacrifice? Sacrifice means giving up one's desire, anger, and greed. Unless you sacrifice desire, anger, and greed, you cannot attain divinity. Remember, every act from sunrise to sunset is a yajna."
Swami then goes on to identify five yajnas declared by the Vedas to be mandatory. These are: study of the scriptures by way of expressing gratitude to the ancients who gave them to us, service to parents by way of expressing gratitude to them for their sacrifices, homage to the deities that control the forces of nature, extending hospitality to the guest, seeing God in the guest, and nurturing plants, trees, animals, etc., recognizing thereby how they too serve us. The essence of it all is, others serve you, so you must serve others in double measure as an expression of gratitude. One might argue that in this day and age, these five yajnas, which are prescribed in the Vedas as mandatory, do not make much sense. Making such an argument would be to totally miss the point. The real point behind the yajnas which have been prescribed is the expression of gratitude. Who except a person devoid of sensitivity can deny that one owes gratitude to one's parents, teachers and ancestors? And what about society? Again and again, Swami reminds us we are what we are because of society. So the real bottom line is that we owe a deep debt of gratitude to all entities, both animate and inanimate, that in diverse ways help to sustain us.
Many young people today seem to think that while they have a right to demand this and that from society, they have hardly any obligation whatsoever in return. This is completely wrong. Who set up the schools and colleges where people receive education? Who prints books that students study? Who provides employment, medical services, electricity, food, water, etc.? Some segment or the other of society. Are these support services available deep in the Amazon rainforest? Whether one likes it or not, one owes much to society. And that is precisely why John F. Kennedy told the youth of America, "Ask not what America can do for you. Instead, ask what you can do for America."
As Swami puts it, there are two complementary aspects to human existence, rights and responsibilities. In olden times, responsibilities had a precedence, but currently, it all seems to be a case of me and me alone. It does not take much reflection to realize that if everyone wants to have a free lunch, then the entire social fabric would collapse in no time at all.
Agreed. But what has the Purusha Suktam got to do with all this? Very simple. It stresses the seamless continuity between man, creation, and God. And all that was just said is related to precisely this seamless continuity. Swami explains this beautifully via the following hierarchy: individual, society, nature, and God. The individual is a limb of society, which is a limb of nature, which in turn is a limb of God. In turn, this hierarchical relationship implies that every action of the individual must be in harmony with society, nature, and God. Take a simple example. When one throws litter and garbage, one is causing disturbance to society. One is polluting the environment. And finally, one is out of sync with God, who is the embodiment of perfection. The hierarchy drawn attention to by Swami is thus profoundly significant.
The point being made by Swami is far from trivial. Driven by greed, big corporations are today fueling unwanted consumption. In turn, this harms the health of huge sections of the population, besides promoting pollution of nature. Not merely that, greed eclipses the fear of sin and makes people forget God. If all this is to be avoided, then it is important to pay careful attention to the content and spirit of the Purusha Suktam and imbibe its teachings, and then apply them sincerely in one's daily life. Times and lifestyles might have changed, but these changes do not make the basic lessons of spirituality irrelevant. On the contrary, they are more relevant to mankind than ever before. By the way, let us not imagine that big corporations and rich alone violate moral laws. If we inquire deeply, each and every one of us is guilty in some way or the other. So really speaking, we should first fix ourselves and overcome our deficiencies before pointing fingers at others. As Swami reminds us, when we point one finger at others, the three of our fingers are actually pointing to us.
The question might arise, if everything is indeed God and there is nothing else, then who is sacrificing for whom? And what is it that is being sacrificed? Krishna has given the answer in the famous Brahmarparam Shlokam that we all chant before partaking of our meals. Krishna says, the act of offering is Brahman. The offering itself is Brahman. The one who offers is Brahman. And the sacred fire into which the offering is made is also Brahman. He alone attains Brahman, who in all his actions is fully absorbed in Brahman. The essence of the Brahmarparam Shlokam is that not only is the entire universe pervaded by God, but that the entire universe is itself God. This concept might be difficult for us to grasp, since all of us are steeped in duality, which keeps God and man separate. Actually, for starters, there is nothing wrong in duality. We can quite legitimately think we are making an offering to God in the sacred fire, but when at long last there is enlightenment, we would realize the identity of the self within. That is to say, the individual Purusha, so-called, with the universal self or Purusha. Now why are we citing the Brahmarparam Shlokam? Because along the line, the Purusha Suktam says that Virata was sacrificed. That remark in the Purusha Suktam should be understood in the light of what Krishna says.
It is interesting at this stage to digress briefly and narrate an important episode in the life of Swami Vivekananda, famous for many things, including his most heroic efforts to bring Eastern knowledge to Western society. Before initiation, Swami Vivekananda was known by the name Narendranath. Well, he was, like most young men of his times, deeply troubled within. There were the problems of life, the social injustices, and the insensitivity of the rich, all of which disturbed Narendra. This made him go in quest of something he knew not what, and his search brought him to Ramakrishna Paramahansa.
Ramakrishna told Vivekananda that everything is God, which of course young Naren flatly refused to believe. With a sarcastic laugh, he told a friend, I am asked to believe that this vessel is God, this cup is God, what we see is God, and we ourselves are God. What nonsense! This conversation was taking place outside Ramakrishna's room. At that moment, Ramakrishna came out, heard the conversation, smiled and simply touched Naren, and this touch sent Naren into some kind of a trance. Let's hear what happened next from Vivekananda himself.
First of all, I began to see the houses, rooms, doors, windows, verandas, the trees, the sun, the moon, all were flying off, shattering to pieces as it were, reduced to atoms and molecules, and all these ultimately became merged in the space. Gradually, space also vanished, and after that, I do not recollect what happened next. I was at first frightened. Coming back from that state again, I began to see the houses, doors, windows, verandas, trees and the other things. On another occasion, I had the same realization by the side of a lake in America.
Vivekananda adds that from that day of this extraordinary experience, he never doubted the non-dual nature of creation. The famous English poet Lord Tennyson also had such experiences of the transcendental state. He says,
"I have frequently had from childhood a kind of waking trance. This has generally come upon me through repeating my own name 2 or 3 times to myself, silently, until at once, as it were, out of the intensity of consciousness of individuality, the individuality itself seemed to dissolve and fade away into boundless being, and this not a confused state, but the clearest of the clearest, the surest of the surest, the weirdest of the weirdest, utterly beyond words, where death was an almost laughable impossibility. I am ashamed of my feeble description. Have I not said that that state is beyond description?"
In a nutshell, though it might be difficult for us to grasp, we had better realize that there is an underlying cosmic unity to which Purusha Suktam calls eloquent attention. And having realized that there exists a divine connecting thread, we must ensure that all our actions have the flavor of sacrifice, so that cosmic integrity is in no way disturbed, even to the slightest extent. In other words, our actions must always be in perfect harmony with society and nature, besides being pleasing to God. As already noted, the Purusha Suktam offers a description of creation and evolution. Obviously, it is allegorical and is not to be interpreted in a literal sense. But does it in any way contradict modern physics? Not really.
The latter half of the 20th century has seen tremendous progress in cosmology, which is the science of the universe itself. This progress is the outcome of intense research by tens of thousands of brilliant physicists working all over the globe. While a good many of these scientists were researching bits and pieces of the mystery, others have been busy in putting all the pieces together, as a result of which a marvelous picture is finally beginning to emerge. While all the details are not in yet, one has a good broad brush picture.
Basically, the picture of the birth and the evolution of the physical universe is as follows. It all started off instantly, as it were, in less than 1/1,000,000,000 of a second. There appeared a very special kind of energy, all of it concentrated in almost a geometrical point. Imagine that, an astronomical amount of energy that adds up to the vast energy that we find in the universe today, all deposited in an infinitesimally small baby universe, literally of zero size. Mind you, this is what modern physics says. This initial deposit of energy is literally the one from which the entire physical universe, with all its current complexities, came later. Where did this initial deposit of energy itself come from? That is a question on which science is silent, perhaps understandably so.
And so in the beginning there was, even according to science, this almost nothing from which everything else came. Before we go further with the picture painted by science, let us first hear what the Vedas proclaim. At first there was neither being nor non-being. There was not air nor yet sky beyond. In the beginning, love rose, which was the primal germ cell of the mind, a cross line being cut between being from non-being. What was described above it was below. Bearers of seed there were, and mighty forces thrust from below and forward move. Who really knows? Who can presume to tell it? Whence was it born? Whence issued this creation? Even the devas came after its emergence. Then who can tell from whence it came? These extraordinary verses occur in the Rig Veda.
Let us now go back for a quick glance at what 20th century science has to say about all this. Modern physics says that essentially, out of what seems like nothing, there appeared an astronomical amount of energy, and very quickly, this energy began to spread. This event, known as the Big Bang, is supposed to mark the birth of our universe about 14 billion years ago. Big Bang cosmology is now almost universally accepted, since many convincing experimental evidences have been discovered for the remnants of the Big Bang. By the way, the expansion of the baby universe that came into existence with the Big Bang also created space and time. In other words, as far as physics is concerned, space and time that we experience came into existence only after the Big Bang and the birth of the embryonic universe.
Agreed that there was this Big Bang that occurred about 14 billion years ago. What happened next? In less than 1 second after the Big Bang, four fundamental forces of nature appeared, as also the basic building blocks associated with them. Meanwhile, the baby universe grew rapidly, and as it grew, more and more complex entities emerged from the primordial ones that had come into existence within 1 second after the Big Bang.
What are these entities that so emerged? First, there were the basic building blocks of matter known as quarks and leptons. From these, then came protons and neutrons. All this happened within 1 short second. Following this, protons and neutrons combined to form the elementary nuclei, like the nucleus of helium, lithium, and so on. Thereafter, the nuclei combined with electrons to form atoms. Meanwhile, the universe continued to expand, and even as it did so, molecules formed, gathering into cosmic clouds, from which later condensed the stars. In turn, the stars aided the formation of planets, and so on. All this process took a long time.
As a part of this continuous evolutionary process, the sun, on which we depend so much, came into existence about maybe 5 or 6 billion years ago. Following this, our dear planet the Earth came into existence as the baby of our own sun about 4 billion years ago. Roughly 1 billion years after that, at a time when our Earth was thus covered essentially with fluid, there emerged the first primitive living molecule that lived, reproduced, and died.
Now, go back to the Vedas. They too say that out of nothing, something emerged. They say that initially there was only darkness. The Purusha Suktam goes further to declare that everything emerged from liquidity. The stanzas we have earlier quoted make a reference to all such matters, though in poetic language. If one considers all these bits and pieces together, one cannot but marvel at the incredible intuitive grasp of the essentials of creation by the Vedic seers. In brief, the Vedic seers saw that everything came from one. They recognized that the diversity that we now see actually came from this one. They further told us evolution brought forth complexity.
The well-known British astronomer Martin Rees says that the frog is far more complex than a galaxy. That is why, according to Martin Rees, we understand much less about the frog than we do about galaxies. And the frog appeared much after galaxies did. In fact, even in science, complexity theory is only just getting started. The Vedas also firmly declare that hidden in the physical universe of bewildering and bewitching beauty, there is one, and he is the only one. He is subtle, but present everywhere nevertheless.
modern physics has confirmed all this in remarkable ways. In a nutshell, the picture is as follows. There is, according to quantum mechanics, an abstract entity called the wave function that describes the physical world. All students of physics readily accept the wave function and work out any number of problems concerning it. But nobody can ever see the wave function, touch it, hear it, or anything like that. It is a subtle entity. In mathematical language, it has both real and imaginary parts. And thanks to the imaginary part, the wave function is totally beyond the senses. And yet, it not only exists but also controls in detail the property of the entity associated with it. Modern physics freely accepts all this. It has no problem whatsoever in doing so. For example, the properties of the hydrogen bomb, which by the way is the simplest among atoms, all are determined entirely by the wave function. So we have here a case of scientists being very comfortable with a mathematical entity that cannot be seen or touched or experienced in any manner whatsoever. Yet, they accept its existence and indeed take it for granted. But when it comes to God, this is a different matter. As Swami asks, who was that who put a red beak on a green parrot? All such wonders of nature are attributed by scientists to the outcomes of random mutations of genetic molecules. One wonders, but let us leave all that aside and go on to something most remarkable that precise experiments have thrown up in the 70s.
The essence of this extraordinary finding is that everything in the universe is connected with everything else. And this connection is at the deepest level of quantum mechanics, at the level of the wave function. In other words, there is, strictly speaking, no unique individuality. Let us hear what physicist Gary Sukov has to say. And this is what he says. The philosophical implication of quantum mechanics is that all things in our universe, including us, that appear to exist independently are actually parts of one all-encompassing organic pattern, and that no parts of that pattern are ever really separate from it or from each other. In short, the physical world, according to quantum mechanics, is not a structure built out of independently existing entities, but rather a web of relationships as a whole. Professor Jeffrey Chu of the University of California makes a similar observation. He says, "Your electrons and mine are only approximately distinguishable. In denying objective reality, quantum mechanics denies absolute status to your individuality. The only individual is the entire universe."
Now, these are the opinions of hardcore physicists stating the findings of rigorous science. And so, 20th century science says that though we may see distinct and diverse forms, what we see is superficial. Underlying these diverse forms is a universal connectivity.
Science does not clarify what that connectivity is, but the Vedas leave no room for speculation. They firmly declare that that connecting thread is God, Atma, the Purusha. Doesn't matter what term we use. The words may seem different, but they all refer to the one and only Supreme Being. As Swami puts it so neatly, bulbs are many, but current is one. We all have heard that so many times, but do we take it seriously? And Swami also says, if you abuse any person, that abuse actually goes to God. You think you are seeing a different person in front of you. There is no different person. It is in fact God, and that same God is in you too. So it is actually a case of abusing yourself. Lord Krishna too makes the same point. That is the bottom line. God is everywhere and in everything in creation. If one reflects calmly on all this, one cannot but wonder how the Vedic seers thousands of years ago had an intuitive grasp of the omnipresence of God.
It is pertinent here to also call attention to some of Plato's observations on the two worlds, the unmanifest world and the manifest world, using the language of the Gita. Plato argued that there was an unmanifest and perfectly ordered world of harmony, and that the manifest world we see is but a projection of the unmanifest, a projection that is sometimes perhaps distorted. Plato's concept has led many to believe that discoveries are made when thinkers, concentrating intensively, roam in a certain domain of Plato's higher world. And then suddenly, as if by accident, they stumble upon a truth. That then appears as a sudden flash of idea. That is the moment when subconsciously the seeker or the investigator has arrived at the correct spot in the unmanifest world of Plato. There are many recorded instances of sudden flashes of intuition. The case of Archimedes is of course well known, but there are other examples also. For example, the famous German mathematician Gauss says, "Like a sudden flash, the problem in the theory of numbers happened to be solved. I myself cannot say what was the connecting thread that connected what I previously knew with what made my success possible."
We now consider the rather contentious issue of the Varna system. As already remarked, the Varna system that the Purusha Suktam describes and which Lord Krishna says he ordained have been widely criticized due to gross ignorance. All critics of the Varna system, confusing it with the caste system of recent times, a system that is unquestionably riddled with unacceptable, horrible and even criminal distortions. It is interesting to note that Gandhiji, who fought intensely against the caste system as we know it, readily accepted the Varna system. That alone ought to make it clear that there is really no room for prejudice on the matter, and that the original Varna system that Lord Krishna talks about and the caste system as we know it with all its evils are totally different.
What exactly is the Varna system, and what does Krishna mean when he says that he ordained the system? The answer is straightforward. No one will disagree that the universe is an expression of diversity, a glorious expression, in fact, and this diversity has an inbuilt divine purpose.
As already remarked, every single entity in creation has a role to play. This applies to everything from the tiny ant to the huge galaxies. Next, that everything is interlinked to everything, not merely at the subtle quantum mechanical level as mentioned previously, but even at the macro level. For example, mountains, trees, etc. are linked to rain, and the universe has been so designed that all entities together play a synergetic role to sustain the universe and support its evolution.
Now, in this grand design, all entities except the human do not have any freedom of choice. Inanimate matter functions according to what we normally describe as the laws of nature, and the laws of nature are what science seeks to discover. What Newton discovered, for example, was a law of nature. As for animals, birds, etc., they too are divinely programmed to function in their own respective ways. The tigress, for example, fiercely protects its cubs. We say it is inbuilt instinct, But where does this instinct come from? From God. In other words, what we describe as instinct is nothing but law of nature as applicable to the beings of the animate world other than humans.
What about humans? What is the law that governs them? Are they also bound with their instincts? Or does God have something different for them? The answer is simple. The humans too have a law that is meant to guide them, but the mind creates a complication. We must here remember that the mind has been specially endowed by God to man. Insects, birds, and animals do not have a mind. What it means is that humans can think, analyze, discriminate, and so on. The power of discrimination is a faculty endowed specially by God only to humans. And thanks to this blessing, if it may be so called, humans have an option. What is that option? The option is to either obey the moral law, which is the special law that humans are supposed to follow, or disobey the moral law. In other words, unlike inanimate entities like the planets or animate entities like the elephant, humans have a choice of either obeying the moral law or violating it.
Now, why on earth did God do this? Well, that is part of his leela or sport. We would never be able to fathom why the Almighty wanted things this way. All we can do is to accept the moral law that is meant to govern us and adhere strictly to it. Let us now put the moral law in juxtaposition to diversity and see what follows. Very simple. Rule 1 is that we must act and function in equilibrium with the diversity that surrounds us and be in harmony with it. Rule 2 is that we must accept diversity in human nature and conduct ourselves in a suitable manner so that there is harmony in society and all are able to contribute and collectively sustain society.
And this precisely is where the Varna system comes into the picture. When Krishna says that he ordained the Varna system, what precisely does he mean? He simply means that in this world, there are people with different attitudes and aptitudes, and that this diversity is inbuilt for the sustenance of the complex system that the universe is.
Society is always stratified, and even in the so-called communist societies, there were intellectuals, there were academics, there were workers, there were administrators, actors, sportspersons, and so on. Thanks to inbuilt attitudes, some like to be engineers, some like to be doctors, some like to be artists, and so forth. That is what stratification of society is all about. And that is what Krishna is drawing attention to.
Agreed that society has an inbuilt stratification. So what? Well, two questions now arise. The first question is, how must the individual function? And the second question is, how must each segment of society function so that overall equilibrium is maintained and that there is peace and harmony? Swami says that the answers to both of these are to be found in the human body.
We have often heard Bhagwan Baba say, the proper study of mankind is man. What precisely does that mean? It simply means that firstly, even as the cell performs its own specified function within the organ it belongs to, so too must the individual. Thus, a doctor must do properly the duty of a doctor. A teacher must do likewise, and so on. Seems trivially obvious, and yet, what is it that we see in today's society? We shall come to that point soon. Turning now to the second question, namely, the role to be played by each strata of society. What the human body teaches us that each strata must function harmoniously along with the others.
To understand this better, let us go back for a moment to the human body. In the human body, we have many systems like the digestive system, the circulatory system, the respiratory system, the excretory system, and so on. All these systems function in perfect harmony, and no system acts as if it is superior to others. There is also give and take that is characteristic of the entire universe.
For example, after a meal, the stomach needs more blood in order to undertake its job of digestion, and consequently, the brain receives less blood supply, which is why all of us feel a bit drowsy after a heavy meal. Does the brain argue and deny the stomach its share? That is what harmony is all about. Next, suppose a piece of dust falls into the eye. Immediately, the hands go to the eye and try to remove the dust. The hands do not say that it is none of their business. This is what cooperation between the various systems is all about.
In other words, Swami says that each individual is like a cell of an organ, while each segment or strata of society is like a specific human system. Taking a lesson from the human body, each individual must discharge the duty appropriate to his or her position in life. And this duty must be performed in full conformity with the moral law referred to. In practical terms, it means constantly observing and strictly adhering to satya and dharma. As far as the various segments of society are concerned, no segment must consider itself as superior and higher and privileged, and must help each other.
Long time ago, when people believed in dharma, things worked fine. But in due course, degeneration set in, and that is because of the wrong exercise of the so-called freedom of choice. Earlier, we compared an individual in society to a cell in a human body. Basically, the cell is programmed to function in a particular way. By contrast, the human, who by the way is the cell of society, can either follow dharma or violate it. Once individuals decide to violate dharma, chaos sets in quickly. Thus, the transformation of a healthy society into a sick society is like the onset of cancer in a human body. First, the cells of one organ begin to behave as they like, making the whole organ diseased. Later, the disease spreads all across the entire human body. That is what basically happens in cancer. And we ought to realize, from all that is going on around us today, that society too can get afflicted with the cancer of degeneration when individuals start flouting dharma as they please.
If we reason along these lines, we would immediately see that the problems of society do not lie in the inbuilt stratification, but in the way humans and the various segments of society conduct themselves. The problem is thus not with the Varna system, as superficial analysts would like us to believe, but with the fact that almost everyone has begun to imagine that dharma is no longer relevant.
Let us go back once again to Gandhi and see what he has to say about the caste system. He says, "Untouchability is not a sanction of religion, it is a device of Satan. The devil has always quoted the scriptures, but scriptures cannot transcend reason and truth. God did not create man with the badge of superiority or inferiority. No scripture that labels a human being as inferior or untouchable because of his or her birth can command our allegiance. It is a denial of God and truth."
Gandhiji clearly understood the difference between what God ordained and the distortions that man later injected into the ideal system of God for purely selfish purposes, giving shady spiritual justifications and the evil distortions. In all this, Gandhiji was merely following the ancients. The ancients of India understood clearly the interrelationship between the seemingly disconnected bits of diversity that we see in the universe. And putting them all together, they give us two simple rules. Rule one is that everything belongs to God, and the individual is merely a trustee of God, expected to handle whatever God has given him or her, and to be solely used for and on behalf of God. Thus, a teacher is expected to teach not for the sake of money, but for the sake of society. This the teacher does by striving hard and by helping the students to develop character. Likewise, when it comes to the different segments of society, the rich, for example, they must not exploit the poor. Rather, they must consider themselves to be the trustees of the wealth which has been given by God, and this wealth must substantially be used for the benefit of society and not for fulfilling their personal desires alone. The trusteeship at the individual and the societal level, that is the unwritten law.
The attitude governing individual actions must be: the customer is not merely king, but God in human form. The patient is not a sick person, but God disguised, who has come to give us an opportunity to serve him, and so on. If every single individual makes an earnest attempt to go through life in this manner, then there is bound to be a significant improvement, and there will be peace and harmony, at least in a large measure. On the other hand, if the principle of live and let live is violated, then one can expect nothing but conflict and chaos. And that precisely is what is happening today in huge measure.
Dear listener, as we wrap up this volume 2 of our series Veda Pushpanjali, we would like to offer a few concluding remarks. First, the Vedas are all about adoration of the Supreme One, and how we must, basing our individual lives on sacrifice, express true adoration for the Supreme One. This adoration, as Swami reminds us ever so often, is not via rituals, but through service. And how must this service be rendered? Swami has an answer for that also. Firstly, we must serve without any expectation of any return or reward. Next, we must serve with joy and love. Thirdly, and this is most important, we must serve by seeing the same God within them as the God who resides in us. There is only one God, and He dwells in all.
The Purusha Suktam, around which this presentation revolves, is one of the innumerable windows offered by the Vedas to get a glimpse of God, man and creation, and the extraordinary relationship between them. They may appear distinct and different to the uninitiated, but as Swami reminds us ever so often, they are actually one and the same. In the beginning, we fail to see this cosmic unity, but in due course, especially by loving all and serving all, as Baba always asks us to, we will experience this oneness with the Divine, whereupon all differences would vanish, as Vivekananda eloquently testifies. Before we end, we would first like you to hear a small clip from a recent Divine discourse.
There are so many mysteries in this nature.
ఇటువంటి రహస్యములు నేటి కూడాను అనేక వేల సంవత్సరం నుంచి కూడాను అనేక మంది సైంటిస్టులు పరిశోధనలు చేస్తూ వస్తున్నారు.
ద సీక్రెట్స్ ఆఫ్ నేచర్ ఆర్ బీయింగ్ అన్రావెల్డ్ ఎక్స్ప్లోర్డ్ ఇన్వెస్టిగేటెడ్ బై సైంటిస్ట్.
ఇట్టి రహస్యాన్ని గుర్తించుకునే నిమిత్తమై మానవులు దైవాన్వేషణ నిమిత్తమై ప్రాకులాడుతూ వచ్చారు.
మ్యాన్ ఇస్ ఇన్ సర్చ్ ఆఫ్ గాడ్ టు నో ద సీక్రెట్స్ ఆఫ్ నేచర్.
దైవాన్ని అన్వేషించటకు వీలు కాదు.
It is not possible to search for God.
కేవలం సామాన్యమైనటువంటి ఒక వస్తు రూపము లేక ఒక శక్తి రూపము అయితే దీన్ని కొంతవరకు పరిశోధన చేయవచ్చును.
God is not an object nor individual to visualize and see him in front of you.
నిద్రను నుండి లేచి మరి నిద్ర పోయుడు దాకా పొట్టకై హద్దును పద్దు లేక ప్రేమందగ చేయిచి జీవితంబు నీవి పెద్దల దారబోసి అరవింద దరాక్షను విస్మరించి ఏ సుఖం పొందినారు మీరు.
Oh man, what comfort have you experienced? What joy have you experienced? Right from the time you get up from bed until you retire, you spend all your time just to carry on your living, forgetting the holy matchless name of God.
Kanuka daiva shakti cheta sarvamulakunu jagatlo sancharistunnavu gaani manavuni yokka sashakti cheta edi kudunu var prayatna purvakanga sadhinchaledu.
Everything is preordained. Everything happens as per the will and the divine command of God, not by human effort.
ఇదే విధంగానే ఈ ప్రపంచంలో అనేక శక్తులు ఉంటున్నవి.
In this world there's so many mighty powers.
ఈ శక్తులన్నీ కూడాను కేవలము ఎవరో పుట్టించారు, ఏదో ఒక శక్తి నుంచి వచ్చినాయి, భగవశక్తి నుంచి ఇవి ఆధారమవుతున్నాయి అని భావిస్తూ ఉంటారు. ఇది భగవశక్తితో వచ్చేటువంటివి కాదు.
People think that these powers are acquired, that they are obtained. Not so.
Idi kevalamu ee prakruti yokka shaktile sahaja shaktimainatundi yokka dinto ivi aavirbhavistu vachayi.
These are natural. The source of all these latent powers is nature itself.
Oka karram teesi deenaina kottinappudu adi chaala baadha padutuntayi.
When you hit anyone with a stick, naturally it causes pain.
Andulo edo ee agni shakti okati unnadi.
Well, there is some power here.
Rayantis denena kottinappudu deentlo edo oka parva shakti untunnadi.
If you pelt a stone and hit anybody, naturally oka
raatiki oka raati kottinappudu daani nunchi agni prarambham avutundali.
When you just strike two stones against each other,
kaani adi agni raati nunchi manaku kanipistundada?
Do you see the fire externally?
Ledu.
No.
గోప్యంగా ఉంటుండి ఎప్పుడు రావాలో అప్పుడు వచ్చి అది కనిపించి భస్మం చేస్తుండాలి.
ద ఫైర్ ఇస్ హిడెన్, ఇట్ కమ్స్ అవుట్ ఎట్ ఎ ప్రాపర్ టైమ్ అండ్ బర్న్స్ ఆల్.
ఈ శక్తులన్నీ కూడాను ఆ సహసిద్ధమైనటువంటి యొక్క సృష్టిలో ఉన్నటువంటివి కానీ ప్రత్యేకంగా భగవంతుడు అనుగ్రహించినటువంటివి కాదు.
దీస్ ఆర్ ద మిస్టరీస్ వండర్స్ ఆఫ్ ద వరల్డ్.
వెల్, దట్ అబౌట్ రాప్స్ ఇట్ అప్. బిఫోర్ వి బ్రింగ్ ద కర్టెన్ డౌన్, let us get the bottom line from Swami himself, beautifully capturing the essence of the Purusha Suktam. He says, just as sugar in cane juice or sweetness in sugar, the Lord is ever immanent in creation. He is the inner core of all beings. He is everywhere and in everything. He has no form. He is the indweller, the Purusha. Only by throwing off the attachment to the body and purifying the mind can you merge with him and earn the purest wisdom and eternal bliss. This is the only path to liberation from bondage and recurring cycles of birth and death.
And now, as a finale, let us, immersed in admiration, hear the Purusha Suktam in its entirety once more, as it is often chanted in the mandir in the divine presence.
Sat Sat Sat.
As we say goodbye, we request that the next time you hear Vedic chants, please take a moment off to reflect on the glory and the universality of the Vedas, even though you might not quite know the meaning of the particular verse being chanted. Irrespective of the words, they always say the same thing. There is only God everywhere, and He is all-powerful. Thank you, and Jai Sairam.